And Johann Sebastian's Concerto for Violin and Didgeridoo introduces yet another edition of LNL. Now, this program is, of course, the tiniest tile in the vast mosaic of media, but it has its moments. And for me, the best moments come when I can get a dear friend into the studio and just have a chat, which is what we're going to do tonight. And dear listener, Gladys, you'll be delighted to know that tonight's special guest is Lois O'Donoghue, CBE, AM, Australian of the Year, Foundation Chairwoman of the National Aboriginal Conference, Founding Chairwoman of ATSIC, and Australian... Yeah, what year were you Oz of the Year, Lois?
1984.
And I got to know Lois because we worked on the National Australia Day Council together and had lots of fun. Now, Lois, we've got an hour to spend, and I want to start by not getting stuck straight into contemporary politics, but looking at your life and wondering how the hell one of the stolen generation gets to be all those things and to do all those things. So let's go back to where you were born, when and where, which is a mere 64 years ago, I understand.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Well, Philip, I was born in the northwest of South Australia at a place at the time called Granite Down Station, later, of course, taking on its Aboriginal name of Indalkina. The Aboriginal community were actually behind a dog-proof fence on a small area of land so that it would not disturb the activities, of course, of the pastoral property, on which my father.
It sounds like pastoral lease at extinguished native title where you were.
Yeah, that's right. So it goes back a long time for me, of course. My father, being a an Irishman who apparently proceeded fairly quickly to the outback of South Australia, as many did, because they were builders. And there are many buildings in the area, homesteads and so on, that I'm told were actually built by my father and others who came to the outback. And he obviously fairly quickly formed a liaison with my mother, whose name was Lily. Later on, of course, when I met her, in 1967, was living with a man by the name of Woodford. So she took on the name at that stage of Lily Woodford. But had only known her as Lily.
Your name, your real name is Lewitcher.
Yes, that's right. And, of course, I've only been able to establish that since I made contact, of course, with my mother and then with my people in the northwest, which, of course, happened in 1967, as I said, which, of course, was a momentous year in many ways, really, not only that I went to the northwest myself to work, as a nurse, of course, with the nurse welfare officer, with the idea in my mind, of course, that it would give me the opportunity to make contact with my mother, of course, which I did very quickly.
Lars, let's roll it back a little bit before
yes.
that. Now, your mother had lost a son and a daughter, and then Amy, Violet, and you are taken. Tell us about that. What do you remember of that?
I don't personally remember anything of it at all. I was 2 years old. But one of my sisters, I was two, Amy was four, and Violet was six, does recollect some of what happened. And she remembers, of course, that we weren't... we were hidden by our mother for quite considerable days. The missionaries had had headed out to Granite Down Station to actually gather up a few more children. And the story goes that my mother, as well as other mothers, hid their children for as long as they could. But, of course, the missionaries were happy enough to stay around to get their small charges at some stage, because they were there for the purposes of bringing to be saved the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island people, the Aboriginal people out there, of course, from what they saw was a pagan culture, the Aboriginal traditional culture, to win them over to Christianity. So they sat around preaching the gospel to those who would listen, and they didn't mind how long they stayed around.
Eventually, well, their patience was rewarded, because they did get you, didn't they, and your sisters?
And so eventually we were, the three of us, taken back to Oodnadatta, where the mission, of course, had a children's home, but it was only a holding centre for us, and we then proceeded down on the train to a place called Corn, a railway town in the Flinders Ranges, where, of course, I have established my own home from time to time. And we joined, of course, the rest of the children that were in the home, and it was called Colebrook Home for half-caste children, because it was not the full-blood children that were removed. It was the so-called half-caste children were removed to bring us to Christianity, and also...
well, also to service, because you were trained to be servants, weren't you?
That's right, yes. I mean, the mission authorities, of course, had no other plans for any of us. The boys would go out to station properties as stockmen, and the girls, of course, all went into domestic service at the age of 16.
You've described Colebrook as a faith mission. What's that mean?
That means that it was a church that was a mission that was supported by the interdenominational churches, and the mission only survived on the gifts from the churches.
But wasn't there also some money that was paid into trust for the kids?
I really don't know too much about that, Philip, but there was certainly no money from government, because the mission authorities always always told us that we ought not to have anything to do with the welfare, and that we should be independent of government. But, of course, the way things operated at the time when we were in the mission, of course, sometimes the stocks got very low, and there were many times, of course, when there was just nothing, nothing to eat. But
no loaves or fishes were available.
No, that's right, but quite often there would be a load of cabbages or cauliflowers, but it always seemed to be a load of a particular thing, or bread it might be, because the baker had baked too much. But we were always told, of course, that that the Lord had provided, and in every instance where there was a gift of some kind brought to the home, we would all be gathered in to sing Praise God, from whom all blessings flow. So I remember singing that hymn many times.
You're not still singing it though, Lois, are you?
No, only when I tell the story.
Look, I just want to go back about your father. Why is it, do you think, that so many of the best-known Aboriginal activists in Australia, like you, had an Irish father?
Well, only because I think that when they immigrated to Australia, they went to the remote areas to look for work, and that's where they were able to pick up work as either station managers And some of them, of course, came to own stations, and one that is at the moment subject of a native title claim is De Rose Hill, not very far away, of which my father and my uncle, his brother, owned at some stage. And I have two cousins. There was Tom, my father, and Mick O'Donoghue, and he had two sons, and both of those cousins at the moment are involved in the native title claim of De Rose Hill.
What was Colebrook like? Was it a tough place?
Yes, it was. It was a very Spartan, but it also was tough. There were two maiden ladies who were the missionaries, one matron and one the deputy matron. The matron, more particularly, was very cruel. The punishment, of course, for very minor misdemeanours like daring to speak your own language and wanting to know if they knew anything about your family and where is my mother and things like that. We received quite severe punishment. There was always leather straps that were soaked in water until they were hard and so on. So, you know, we did get it. She did meter out fairly horrendous punishment.
Was there any feeling at any point in your first 16 years of being loved?
No, not from my point of view. But Philip, what I have to say this, that for the most part, the children who were brought up in Colebrook Home will not speak of the punishment, or will not speak against the missionaries at all. There is the greatest loyalty for them. But I've made the point, and have said it quite often, to those who, of course, we have regular contact. We have an organisation that's incorporated that's called Colebrook Community Organisation, that while they were alive, I think we did everything that we could to make their lives as comfortable as we could until the end of their days. But I think now that we have the inquiry, and that really it is time for us to speak out about the fact that things weren't as rosy.
But you spoke out from the beginning, didn't you? Because one of the reasons you were strapped by the matron is you'd speak out for the other kids.
I did, and my sisters in particular, I thought, were treated very badly. There were those, of course, in the home who were the so-called pets, so there was no punishment meted out to them. But right throughout my childhood, I would grab the strap and I just wouldn't tolerate the fact that any of my sisters or anyone was receiving you know, that sort of treatment.
Tell me this, was the warmth of treatment in any way related to skin colour?
No, I don't think so, Philip.
Now, you escape from the gravitational pull of domestic service. You get yourself a nursing apprenticeship at the Victor Harbour Hospital. You're 18 years of age. 10 years later, you find your mother. Let's go to that story now, because you started to tell it before. Tell us about how you find your mother when there's no photos from that time, no birth certificate. You know, you'd been to India for a couple of years as a relief nurse, but it was very difficult to verify your identity, your existence, so you could get a passport.
Yeah, so, Philip, what I decided was that prior to deciding that I would I'd join the Department of Aboriginal Affairs, which was a state department that provided welfare services to Aboriginal people in South Australia. previously the department had tried to recruit me to work for them, but I'd always been not ready for it, and I was always afraid about the idea of becoming exempt, which was the difficult thing we had, and not only in South Australia but other states where the protective Aborigines would constantly contact us to say that because we were half castes, we needed to be exempt and become whites. And I resisted that all throughout my nursing training.
This is a great honour you were being offered.
Yes.
How did you knock that back?
Yeah, one that I didn't want. I kept as far away as I could from the department. But after I came back from India, had seen the conditions in India, and I thought now I was in control sufficiently of my own life to now launch out a bit, and that I'd be able to stand up to the department. So I joined the Department of Aboriginal Affairs and asked if I could have a posting somewhere in the north of South Australia. And I knew that there was a vacancy at Coober Pedy, which, of course, is a mining town with a population of Aboriginal people. So I proceeded to take up my job in Coober Pedy. I arrived in the town. I went to the one and only supermarket in the town to get my stores to go out to the Aboriginal reserve outside the town. And there was a group of Aboriginal people sitting outside of the supermarket who said, "That's Lily's daughter."
How did they know?
With the purpose, well, I mean, after meeting my mother, of course, I can see, you know, that they would see me because I looked very much like my mother.
In other words, they could see her face in your face.
They could see, yeah, in me. And I walked over to them. And this is the first time, not only the first time, but it really came home to me that here I was not able to have a conversation with them, because the thing that I regret most about being removed from my mother was the fact that, you know...
You lost your language.
I lost my language, I lost my culture, and I lost my family, but I lost my language, which was the thing that I... was impressed upon me, of course, in taking up the job. But I went over and I tried as best I could, because we retained a little bit of the language. There were always new children coming into the home, and we'd get into huddle and we'd attempt.
You'd threaten. You'd risk the strap, would you?
We'd risk. Yes, we would.
Get a couple more words for the vocabulary. Yeah.
That's right. And say, you know, do you know my mother and where is she, and that sort of thing. And of course, that was the punishment. We received punishment for that. So I indicated to them, yes, I was Lily's daughter. Where was she, and who were they, and were they related to me? I found in the group that that I had an auntie and an uncle. Both of them were. One was my mother's sister and my mother's brother, and the others, of course, were very closely related, extended family. And, of course, immediately they were upset and started, of course, to cry and say, you know, you should go, your mother's at Oodnadatta, you should go in to her right away.
Is it true that when your mother heard you were coming to look for her, that she waited by the road from morning till night for 3 months?
Yes, that's right. So she was out every day, and she only went home at dusk for the 3 months, because it took me 3 months. I had to try and get them to understand that I'd come there to work. I was the nursing sister and the welfare officer for the area, and so that they should come and talk to me out at the reserve at my home. And so we did, and we worked out an itinerary to go up at some stage. It was fortunate for me, but unfortunate for the nurse who was working in the northwest of the state, that she'd actually rolled a vehicle, and I was asked, would I do the northwest clinic as well, of course, which was right in Pinjarra Lands. And so 3 months later, I got in touch with my elder sister, Eileen, because I didn't indicate that years before that two other children had been removed as well. Eileen, my elder sister, and Geoffrey, my only brother, had been removed quite a few years earlier. And they were also in Colebrook, so we were reunited with them. And so I asked Eileen, would she come up through to Unadatta with me? And she was happy to do so, so we proceeded through. And when I got there, I thought I was going to be the very special daughter, because I believed that I was the baby in the family, the youngest, Eileen being the eldest. But I think Mum had got used to the idea that I was coming, but she didn't know that Eileen was coming. And so, in a way, it was a bit of a letdown for me, Philip, because Eileen received all the attention, because she was the first child. But Mum lost interest, seemed to lose interest very quickly. She wasn't even on the side of the road. I forgot about that. She wasn't on the side of the road when we arrived, because we arrived in after dark. And I said to my uncles that we'd picked up on the way, look, we want to meet Mum tonight. So they went off into the darkness and brought Mum back. Mum had left and gone back to the camp, which was, of course, was just a humpy lean-to. She'd gone back because she thought that, you know, we weren't coming in.
But, Lois, you're talking about a 27-year separation. Even though perhaps you were sort of pipped at the post by your sister, it must have been an overwhelming experience.
Well, it was. And, of course, once again, we couldn't communicate with her in the way we wanted to. She greeted us, and then she appeared to lose interest in us very quickly, and wanted to leave. And I gathered by that she was worried that she was expected to accommodate us. So I indicated through an interpreter that was she worried that we were coming to stay, and that's the answer that came back. So I quickly.
You mean that she was embarrassed at the thought of taking you back?
Very.
Right.
Very embarrassed.
Fancy when you meet your mum, you've got to have an interpreter.
Yes, that was the case. So I said, look, it's all right, Mum. We're staying at the hotel, this little hotel at Unadatta. But we were staying for a few days, and we'd want to meet everyone. So she, of her own volition, came to the hotel every morning to pick us up, escorted us around the town, and then took us back to the hotel. That was her way of telling us that she didn't want us to see her conditions.
Did she live long enough to know how successful her daughter was going to be?
Well, only insofar as it was soon after, of course, I joined the department and I was doing a few things, but not long enough, no, to actually see me go into, I guess, international, you know, politics.
Notoriety, I would think, is the word we're looking for. talked hot favourite to be Governor General and all sorts of things.
No. She didn't live long enough to see that, Philip.
Okay, Lois, let's now move forward quite a few years. My first image of you, the first time we met, I don't know if you recall it, it was at a conference that ATSIC organised on media-related issues in Brisbane. And it was, like many an ATSIC conference, quite a bun fight. You know, people have to understand that Aboriginal politics is by no means monolithic. And it was, to say the least, energetic. And I had this impression of you. You were sitting under an umbrella, and we sat down together and had a chat. And you were surrounded by tension, anxiety, anger, idealism, dreams, everything. And you were remarkably tranquil. And I've seen you under pressure a great many times since. And few people have been under as much, because we've got to remind the listener, of course, that you're also one of the Mabo negotiators. How have you managed, with that background, how have you managed as a kidnapped child, a child who grew up without ever knowing what love felt like, how is it that you are, in fact, so remarkably amiable, tolerant and good-natured? Or is this just a clever veneer covering up God knows what?
Yes, well, I think it probably... it's discipline, I think. It's a discipline, I think, and I think that I'd have to acknowledge that one of the things that I gained, of course, from institutional life, I guess, was discipline. So I think basically it's just been discipline and I have, of course, hidden, I guess, a fair bit.
At your own cost?
At my own cost, yes. I guess I can articulate that a bit since I've left the commission, and what happened to me at the end, of course, in terms of expending, I guess, all my energy in the cause of helping my people and going down as sick as I did at the end.
Well, you damn near died in January, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. Mm. So I've been able to do that, and I think Aboriginal people notice it too and have often said to me, you know, how do you hang in there and how do you keep turning up?
Well, you have this ability to always be calm in the middle of a maelstrom, and it's a gift I've never had, and I admire it enormously. And also, of course, a huge sense of humour, because we had some pretty funny meetings, you and I, didn't we? Now, okay, reconciliation. Well, in a way, the Aboriginal people themselves also approach the big issues, the agonies of their predicament, with, I think, astonishing goodwill and humour. I've always wondered why there isn't more open rage in your community. Why is it that Aborigines, after a couple of hundred years of being dispossessed, debauched, maltreated in every way, can still come back to a negotiating table, can come back to the notion of reconciliation with a welcoming smile on their face, ready to deal reasonably and without rancour?
Well, I think we have no choice, Philip. You know, we're really the most disadvantaged. We're a minority, and while we're not an angry people to start with, but I don't think we have any choice at all, given our disadvantage and our minority status, that we can afford to be angry and to demonstrate.
There was a moment, of course, wasn't there, during the 60s when ideas were rushing into Australia from the civil rights movement, when suddenly you'd see an Afro haircut on an Aborigine in Australia, and some of the whole sort of dynamic of that was informing the debate. But
well, I remember that, of course, and of course there were, I guess, things like there were many Aboriginal women married, of course, to non-Aboriginal men. During that period, of course, those marriages broke up, It was a matter of the women, of course, finding Aboriginal men. And the theme was breed, baby, breed, you know, because we were being bred out.
So it was two things. And Black is Beautiful was also a theme at the
beautiful.
Time. And breed, yep. breed, baby, breed.
Be, baby, breed, and Black is Beautiful. And that really helped us, I think, through those difficult times.
Isn't it interesting that now, these days, Aboriginal politics is unique? It doesn't derive from overseas models. What you've done is hammer out your own methods of dealing with prejudice, bigotry, bureaucracy, government, hostility. But it doesn't now derive. It's not second-hand Black politics.
No. And it's looked at... in my dealings, of course, with the United Nations over the period of my chairmanship of ATSIC, where, of course, we resolved from the first year that we were no longer going to sit on the government benches at the UN forums and that we would seek independent seating. There was no independent status for us, but that we would seek independent seating. And in the time that we went there, I think they watched ATSIC's leadership in the United Nations forums, and other Indigenous people have come during that period of time to study what was happening here, because they couldn't understand how we could move quite freely between the government benches, advising them and at the same time reviewing developments at home and criticising the government for inaction in a whole range of areas. That just fascinated Indigenous people around the world, that was possible. And so many have studied, of course, the ATSIC model and the way we do things. But I'm fearful of what might happen to ATSIC with this new government, and if in fact it doesn't operate, you know, the way, I mean, the previous government, of course, understood that there were times, of course, when even, but at the time we made the decision about the United Nations, Hawke was worried, of course, that our motive was to embarrass the Australian government on the international arena. But they come to understand that, you know, later on, that we would express our views, and many times our views would be different from what was government policy.
It's a difficult act, though, isn't it? For you at ATSIC, you were often walking on eggs.
Very difficult for the chairman.
Yeah, because insofar as you seemed to be close to Keating during Mabo, people often felt that you were uncomfortably close. But I remember, on the other hand, the press conference you called when the negotiations weren't going so good, where you really put the heat on, didn't you?
Yes, and I think this government, of course, I think is still thinking. I think that. I think they're happy that I have gone, because I was too close, they felt, to the Labor government. But I did attempt to get them to understand that, you know, if we had a disagreement with the government, we made that point during the government. I mean, Keating accused us of not being good negotiators. And there were many, many things that we had to fight for in the negotiations. We won some and we lost some.
Well, I can remember as if it were yesterday when you won, and it seemed to me a remarkable moment in Australia. In fact, you know, I hope no one's listening, but I actually had a bit of a cry, because I thought it was just such an extraordinary moment in our history that we'd brought it off, that this process of reconciliation had suddenly taken a great leap forward. Now, of course, things aren't looking so good, and you recently said that it was intolerable the way the present government wanted to legislate away rights to native title. And this is a quote of yours: we would be back on the streets marching and demonstrating. So that may be necessary, do you think?
Yes, I think so. I think this government, I'm, of course, won't be part of the negotiations this time round. I think that this government's only going through the motions at this point in time in relation to the negotiations. The government's position, I feel sure, is to legislate away coexistence, native title.
If that is their position, they've got to take into account the political dynamics of what is, I think, to the 90s, what the Vietnam issue was to the 60s. Now, I mentioned to you on the phone the other day that at the Sydney Town Hall last week, when I was introducing various notables to an audience of about 3,000 people, ex-prime ministers and premiers and other heroes, that it was when I asked Noel Pearson to stand up that the place just erupted. Now, I've seen that phenomenon occur in other places, particularly with young people. They seem to me to have a passionate sense of advocacy in terms of Aboriginal politics. It will, in fact, be the biggest political row this government could imagine.
Yes, and I don't think they understand it. I mean, as I move around the country, before I left ATSIC and since I've left ATSIC, I can't get through an airport without people stopping me and thanking me for what I did, and just want to shake my hand, you know, and so on. So really, I think they do care, and they are taking a lot of note of what's happening.
We've got to admit, however, that it's not all not as simple as I might be suggesting. It's not Lois O'Donoghue versus any federal government. You had a huge amount of trouble with internal political squabbles amongst your own people.
Yes, that's right. Well, I think I made that point in my press conference too, and I made it at the time many times with my people, and particularly when the budget was when we had a budget cut, and I indicated, of course, to my people that I thought that it was a time for us to reflect on the past, and also to look at the programs and so on, and where we were going, and that in fact there may be a need for change, and that there was a lot of duplication and so on. So we need ourselves to. It's a time of reflection.
Yeah, but Lois, what I'm getting at is not every member of the ATSIC board was a wholehearted supporter of you, and there were some real Donnybrooks during that time. And I make the point that, of course, the notion of the Aboriginal nation is a dubious one, given that at the time of white settlement there were 500-plus language groupings. But it's only in recent history that a sense of cohesive Aboriginality has really been a factor, hasn't it, in our political equation.
Yeah, yes, that's true. But I don't think the problems that that I had in relation to the ATSIC board a whole lot different from organisations, big organisations. There's always, you always have your detractors and so on. But it didn't make life easier, but a lot of that, of course, had to do with the fact that I was appointed and they were elected. So the notion of an appointed chair will always have its problems.
Yeah.
This term, of course, was... It was meant to be fully elected, and the government's returned to an appointed chair. So if my successor, of course, feels that he can always please the government in terms of how he'll conduct affairs in the commission, he'll be reminded on a fairly regular basis that he's not the commission. And that he's appointed and the others are elected.
Mm, so he's inherited that that poison chalice from you, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has.
Look, how has it been as a woman in the world of Indigenous politics, dominated, it would seem, by men?
There's been no difficulty whatsoever. I think my seniority, of course, had a lot to do with the acceptance and so on that I had, that I'd been around for a long time. I was now grey, and that goes a long way in Aboriginal affairs. So a young woman, of course, would have much greater difficulty than I had.
Well, I see Marcia Langton sometimes having that difficulty.
Yes. Yes.
Because Marcia hasn't got as much mileage on the clock as you, has she?
No.
Perhaps well, a grey rinse, you think, might be the... might help.
may help, yes.
Over the years, I talked about a poison chalice.
She's not as patient as I am either.
No, she blows her stack quite spectacularly. Over the years, I would have thought the ministry that nobody ever wanted was always Aboriginal Affairs. There's been a couple of people who've tried valiantly on both sides of the house, I think, to make a go of it, but it is an intensely difficult ministry. Looking back over the years at the various ministers you've worked with or coped with, who did you admire, and who were the lemons?
Well, I thought that Ian Viner did a good job. Ian Viner was the first and only Minister for Aboriginal Affairs in the Cabinet. I don't think he gets a lot of credit for what he did, but I think that he certainly was a good Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, and it was Fred Cheney who came in, I think, and picked up the kudos, I think, for some of the things that Viner had already started.
But in Viner and Cheney, you had two people who were at least struggling to understand and trying to learn enough so that they could be appropriately sensitive.
Yes, but on the other hand, I think they handled it very well. I would say both of those would go down in history, I think, as being good ministers for a good... good ministers.
And Cheney, of course, still soldiers on, doesn't he? Now he's out of the body politic, he's out of the Liberal Party, but he's still very concerned with Aboriginal issues. What about on the Labor side? Did you, Clyde Hole and Gerry Hand?
Gerry Hand and Robert Tickner, of course, was very good, but he wore his heart on his sleeve a bit.
And it wasn't a good thing to do that with that particular... Well, with either the Hawke or Keating governments.
That's right, and that's not a good thing to do. He was very sensitive and over-emotional, of course, and that often didn't bring the support that he needed in Cabinet and so on. So, but he was... I think people think that he wasn't... so concerned about accountability, but Robert Tickner preached accountability every day of his time as minister. So he was very concerned about that we should be accountable for the funds we received from the government. But basically, I think that Gerry Hand was a good, strong minister. He, of course, was the minister.
Well, he founded
who
ATSIC,
appointed
didn't
me.
He? Yes, it was his era.
So he founded ATSIC. At the time, I said that they gave us an organisation, of course, that wasn't manageable and didn't give us the resources and so on to do it. But we had the capacity, of course, in time under the Act to review in each term how the Act was going. Of course, all Aboriginal legislation, of course, is very difficult, and I think the difficulty about Aboriginal legislation is number of amendments, because both the ATSIC legislation and the Native Title legislation have broken all records in terms of the number of amendments that have been introduced. And when you have so many amendments, I think at the end of the day you get a piece of legislation that's almost impossible to administer.
Well, it may have quite a few more, as we see these abrasions between pastoral leases, mining leases, native title, state governments jumping up and down. It's going to be a pretty rugged period for whoever's in office. Now, do you have a wish list or perhaps a wick list for the future of Indigenous politics, Lois? I mean, if you were still in charge down there, what would you be trying to bring about?
Well, in the first instance, I think that it's important, as we've been talking about WIC, it's important that there are compromises, I think, on all sides. I think there is an answer. Obviously, Aboriginal people are not going to...
Well, you're not going to go back behind the dog-proof fences, are you?
We're not going behind the dog-proof fences again, and we're not going to allow extinguishment of native title, and that shouldn't be expected. But obviously, something has to give, and it's important that all parties, all the stakeholders and so on, recognise that it's not going to be satisfactory.
But, Lois, isn't it true that over the years, it's always the Aborigines that have given... In other words, lines are drawn in the sand, the pressures mount, Aborigines then step back and... I mean, for instance, as you pointed out, I think at the press club, farmers and miners receive more than the ATSIC budget as a fuel rebate on diesel. The power of the pastoralists, the power of the mining companies, is politically immense. And despite the moral authority of your cause, you know, when push comes to shove... Isn't it the Aborigines yet again who are going to have to negotiate down, backwards?
Well, it is, and I get the feeling, of course, that the negotiators are not going to give in this time, but there might be some matters on the edges that they would prepare to negotiate. So that's going to be a very tense time, but they really should move on now in terms of... because... I think the government's only going through the motions now to working on the senators in the Senate, because I think that's all where it's going to count now as to whether it's going to get through, and if Hindmarsh Island is any example, well then hopefully that'll be the same with the
with the bigger issues. Yeah.
Yes, the bigger issue in relation to ATSIC. I don't know whether you remember, but about the time that the new government was elected, I was talking about that there needed to be some changes to ATSIC, and I was the reference I made was to the separation of powers.
Yes.
I think there are great difficulties for the Commission to continue with the regional councillors and commissioners making decisions about individual grants, because it's just a huge conflict of interest. Many of our people, of course, stand for election with the express purpose of getting on regional councils to make decisions about grants to their own organisations. So there
But you've argued against that for years, haven't you?
I have. This government is interested in it. The elected representatives are not... and so, but that is certainly one area that I discussed, sent out discussion paper to the regional councils. They will be having to consider this again, and I hope that they will see that that what is important for them is to get involved in the policy decisions. And I had great difficulty in getting feedback from regional councils about major policy decisions that we had to make. And we made them often without any feedback because they were too busy squabbling over the budget. So I think it's important that they look at these things more carefully and realise that they're leaving themselves very open at the moment to a huge conflict of interest, and they should just separate themselves from it.
Now, having moved house 4 times in 8 months due to threats, you're now living in Adelaide. You're technically retired, but I guess you won't be able to stop coming out and swinging punches.
No. I intend to do that. I'm already back... travelling much more than I had hoped I would, and doing speaking engagements around. I will have to learn to say no to a few things.
Perhaps charge for them, Lois, might be the answer.
Yes, well,
you can't keep doing freebies. Not a woman of 65.
Well, I'm finding that very difficult at the moment because I have no administrative support whatsoever.
That's the trouble when you leave high office, Lois. You lose all the whistles and bells, don't you?
That's right.
The word processors and the people that help.
I think it's easier, of course, for a personal assistant to put these kind of propositions, of course, to people who want you to speak.
Now, I told you this morning, what you do is you get an answering machine and just keep saying, bugger off. I mean, it's... we'll have a whip round and buy you one. Look, Lois, we've got to wrap it. It's wonderful to talk to you. That was, in fact, I should have mentioned during the program for people who tuned in. That's the remarkable Lois O'Donoghue. Lois, I'm glad you're feeling better. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much, Philip.
Now,
bye-bye.
Bye, my dear. Now, next week on the program, we go deep inside the net to discover the relationships which exist there, trust and respect in the net, and we hear the confessions of a TV weatherman. And one of my guests is a Burmese woman living in exile in Thailand, Tet Tet Lewin, and some 20,000 Burmese refugees, people known as the Karen, have escaped to the Thai border. But aid workers are grappling with feeding so many of them, and there are night attacks and intimidation as well. That report next week. And on Sunday, Gladys, a public forum in Sydney is being presented by the Watershed Group, in which I have an interest. It's a one-day forum, this Sunday the 23rd of Feb. It's a mixture of panel discussions, literary readings, formal and semi-theatrical presentations, relying on audience participation. You can join Donald Horn, Joan Kerner, Veronica Brady, Henry Reynolds, Angela Chan. The Watershed Conversation is on at Blackfriars Campus at Chippendale in Sydney from 9:30 to 4:30. That's at the UTS, the Blackfriars Campus. Now, thanks, dear colleagues, EP Gary McBryson, Chris Short, Donna McLaughlin, Sarah Bladen, and technical production from Manny Waterstream. Now, stick around for Radio National's PM, and I'll see you on Monday.